Coming up next, this week, computer hardware, $1,500 4K HD TV preview. Should you skip OCZ's new SSDs? What does VSync do to gaming animation? Haswell should be very good to battery life and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 214, recorded April 18th, 2013. GTX 700 might be on the way.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Manpax, manly goods on a schedule. Get started today and have underwear, socks, toiletries, shaving supplies, and more delivered to your door. Visit manpax.com/twit and get $10 off your first order of $30 or $50 gift card for $40.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims, well, to bring you the best in computer hardware news. It's simple. We love fast machines, we love inexpensive machines, and we love all the machines in between. And occasionally, we'll even show some love to a tablet or special guest star on today's show, a 4K television, HD television that sells for a mere $1,500 off of Tiger Direct. Mr. Ryan Shrout, you have we're waiting for ours to come in that we're going to benchmark test. Robert's going to put all his colorimeters on it. You, however, have touched the Seiki or Seikai.
I don't know how to pronounce it. I think I was calling it Seiki. I don't know what I was calling it.
Seiki, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because just last week at AC Nation, we were talking about how it's exciting. Sony's got the 4K. Sony's 4K televisions are around the price of an inexpensive used car, inexpensive by today's standards, like $4,000 or $5,000. And then literally less than a week later, Tiger Direct has this television from it's an interesting manufacturer, right? They make HDTVs. They're usually in the $300-$500 range. We don't know if they scored a particular deal on this glass or if this is a one-time shot, a limited run, or if they're going to be selling these continuously, but it is a legit 4K television. 50 or 55 inches, Ryan?
It's a 50-inch TV. And, you know, to be honest with you, I'm not equipped to be a good reviewer of televisions. I'm actually eager to have Robert get his and kind of make a general purpose review of the TV as a 1080p screen versus as a 4K screen and all that kind of stuff. I was, it's when I bought it, it was actually only $1,299. It was $1,300. It's gone up a couple hundred bucks since, but it's kind of cheaply made as you would expect since it's like the cheapest 4K TV you can buy by far.
By thousands.
Yeah, but the simplicity of it is still there, right? It ships with a cable, what they call an ultra high definition ready HDMI cable. I don't think it's really necessary to have it, but maybe it is.
It's essentially HDMI 1.4, if memory serves.
Right. Yeah, and it's a nice cable. It's a braided cable, and whatever. It's a nice cable. But all I did was plug in the power, hook it up to a GTX 680 SLI system that we have running graphics testing currently, and turn it on, and it detected it as a 3840 by 2160 display.
Okay.
At a refresh rate of 30 hertz, which is exactly what we expected it to be. This is part of the video where I almost dropped the TV on the face of it.
We had a stand collapse underneath a $5,000, Pioneer plasma once. It was heartbreaking.
Yeah, I didn't break it, so that's the important part. What I was surprised with, obviously you have a 50-inch 4K TV. You're looking at the Windows desktop. Icons are tiny. But I didn't see a lot of flicker on the desktop. Like, you know, you'll sometimes have when you hook up a TV to a computer where it's not really usable as a PC monitor.
Because the refresh rate is so low.
Yeah, but I don't know exactly how to explain it, right? Because this is a 30 hertz. It's getting a 30 hertz signal, but it's a 120 hertz interpolated TV, right? So I think that actually made the desktop experience of using the TV a lot better. But I will tell you that the phenomena that I discovered that I don't like that I want Robert to dive into and explain is when I was playing back some 4K downloaded content and playing some games at 3840 by 2160, which looked awesome the most of the time. When things were still or when things were slow, the image looked astounding. Right. Slow motion video running at 4K looked awesome. When we were playing games, we would see this kind of flickering, shimmering effect, almost as if the textures in the game were like a couple, you know, not so many years ago, but years ago that you would see texture shimmering when you were playing a game like off in the distance. And then as our anisotropic filtering capabilities got better on graphics cards and drivers, that went away. And it kind of reminds me of that. As you move from left to right, it almost appears like the images get darker and lighter successively. And, you know, when you stop, it gets brighter. And when you're moving from side to side, it kind of looks a little bit dimmer.
Were there picture mode options inside of, and we should explain part of the reason Seiki or Seikai was able to produce this television so cheaply is they basically, you know, they do put an HDMI cable in the case, which is unusual, or in the box, right? Because most HDTVs strip pretty bare. But their whole point is like, you got three HDMI inputs, you got a monitor. We don't want to do speakers. We don't want to do computers. If you want to attach all this, if you want Netflix, buy a Roku box, buy an Apple TV, connect it to a PC. But we're going to give you the best flat panel we can for the least amount of money that we can deliver it. So you have this very stripped down experience. I'm curious if it's a processing issue, or if there was maybe some setting inside of there that you can manipulate to turn that on or off.
I looked at just the basic menu settings you could get to. We did a quick Google search, see if we could find, you know, service menus and that kind of stuff, and were unsuccessful. But there was something they have called dynamic luminance control or something like that, and I saw no difference having it turned on or turned off. And what I was thinking was maybe what I need to do is turn off the 120 hertz interpolation, but I saw no option to do that and that kind of stuff too. So I will let, I really bought it for was let's test games at 4K resolutions.
Right.
And can we use our frame rating performance tests on a 4K output display? And we're very, very close. We were very, very close to being able to figure out how to do it this afternoon, but we are, exceeding our bandwidth limitation again in that regard.
Will any DX11 game support that a 4K resolution, or are only select games going to support that?
I think I ran Battlefield 3, Crysis 3, Tomb Raider, and Skyrim, and I think maybe one more. No, I think it was it. I tried to do Bioshock, but I didn't have it installed on that PC, and they all recognized it right away. And so as long as it's not like iFinity or NVIDIA Surround where it's a custom aspect ratio, this is a 16:9 resolution. So it just should work out of the box. Every game should be able to support it as long as the NVIDIA or AMD control panel works with it, right? And that was something else we wanted to point out. There was some confusion even between Robert and I when we were talking about buying this particular TV, was what video card supported it. And NVIDIA and AMD both in their current generation of cards will run 4K resolutions at 30 hertz over HDMI. So that was not a problem.
Exciting stuff. Exciting stuff. I mean, and also right now, gaming the killer app for 4K because there's almost no 4K content. There's going to be like 10 movies from Sony, which will, you know, get with the $700 Sony 4K player available this summer. And there's, you know, some 4K content online, but it is thin and far between. Not so thin and far between, however, frame rating, the visual effects of VSync on gaming animation. Mr. Shrout, is this your magnum opus addressing the curiosity and concerns about the actual end user detectable nature of VSync and VSync testing?
This is nowhere near as long of an article as the initial one we did on frame rating. This one is more of a kind of a quick and dirt, right? Yeah, comparison, right? So what we did was we tried to take the vendor out of the equation. We're not doing AMD versus NVIDIA. We're not doing SLI versus Crossfire. We're not comparing specific cards. We wanted to demonstrate how a lot of people were of the opinion that VSync, enabling VSync, was the perfect answer to fixing any potential frame time variance stutter problems. And we wanted to demonstrate that that was not the case. So what we did was we made three videos. We made a 60 frames per second static video, and then we made a 30 frames per second static video. And we made those just by using super high-end product. Like I think we used Titan SLI that was way overpowered for the game, the resolution, the settings we were running at. So we had never we were basically never running under 60 frames per second. So we got a static, best case, 60 frames per second result. And we did the same thing on at 30 frames per second because NVIDIA has a feature called adaptive half refresh rate VSync. Don't worry about what it does. It allowed us to capture a static 30 frames per second fixed result. And then what we did is we took a card that we just enabled regular VSync on, and this card didn't have enough performance to stay above 60 frames per second the whole time. So it was dipping down into lower frame rates and then going back up and dipping down and going back up and so on. And that is kind of what I consider a typical user experience. You know, where you have the settings tweaked just enough in your game that you feel like you're going to be pretty close to 60 frames per second. And so you if you're going to go way below that, you kind of turn some things off, so you're a little bit higher. And if you're way too high, if you have the capability, you would turn more quality settings up so you get a better gaming experience out of it. So what we did was we made some videos and we showed you some graphs comparing these different things. And while we do have versions of these on YouTube, I really, really, really recommend you all download the MP4s that we have links where you can actually download the videos directly and look at them side by side. Looking at something through a flash player on YouTube, not the best way to compare visual quality side by side. And if you look in our comments of our story, you'll see people who like watched it on YouTube and they said they couldn't really tell a difference, but then now they download the videos because the videos are encoded at 60 frames per second. They're encoded at 10 megabit, that kind of stuff. So you're going to get better quality out of it. And it's kind of interesting. We did one with Battlefield 3 where we showed you the video and I explained what I saw, why I think that was, and why I thought one was better than the other. And then on the next page, we did one with Sleeping Dogs where we showed you all the videos, we gave you all the data, and then asked you to fill out a poll to like, which ones did you think were better? Which one did you think was which? And then go to the next page and you kind of get your answers and that kind of stuff. So it's pretty interesting to see. The comparisons were 60 versus 30, and that should be pretty obvious to look at. If you see a 60 frames per second animation versus a 30 frames per second animation, you'll be able to tell them apart, I think, pretty easily. We compare 60 versus VSync, and you should be able to tell that. And then the one that was interesting was the 30 frames per second versus VSync, because what's interesting about that is the VSync result has a higher average frame rate per second, but it's not a consistent frame rate inside that second. Whereas the 30 frames per second is slower, but it is consistent and regular, and it's, you know, there's no kind of pausing or stuttering involved in that. So I'm very curious to see. We're going to let this go for another week, I guess, to see which ones people really thought were the best in that regard. And I think it's going to be pretty close. I think it's going to be split pretty evenly. But I would if you want to go do this, I would like you guys to all, you know, go to PCBear.com, find the story, and download the videos. Don't just depend on the YouTube ones. They're kind of there for reference. But download the videos and then kind of get an answer for yourself. Because I think as we explore more of these topics, it's important to really kind of set these definitions and to kind of take on these ideas where there was a longstanding thought that just enable VSync, it makes everything great. And it makes some things better and it makes some things worse. And this is one of the things that it can make worse.
Woohoo.
Yeah.
OCZ Vertex 3.20 240 gigabyte SSD review. It's kind of a letdown after last week. We were talking 960 gigabytes of SSD glory.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, you know, much like a Samsung 840, this is something you can actually afford, relatively speaking. So Alan Malventano writes it up for PC Per. A while back, we saw OCZ undergo a major restructuring. 150-plus product SKUs were removed from their lineup, leaving a solid core group of products for the company to focus on. The Vertex and Agility lines were spared, and the Vector was introduced and well-received by the community. With all that product trimming, we were bound to see another release at some point. And in this case, it is the basically the Vertex 3.20, basically a Vertex 3 with a 25 nanometer IMFT sync flash replaced by the newer 20 nanometer IMFT sync flash. So basically, endurance goes down, write endurance goes down, 3,000 cycles down from 5,000 cycles, but you basically get more dies per 300 millimeter wafer, which means you get more memory for less money, to loosely overstate. I assume Alan talked about this last night on the PC Pro podcast?
Yeah, so performance, it was not quite as great a show as we had expected. Performance was a little bit lower than in particular, the Intel 335 SSD that uses the same controller, the same memory, but it was running a little bit slower. And then because of that, it wasn't any cheaper than that drive. Okay. It didn't make a whole lot of sense, right? So what we'd like to see is either performance of this drive come up through a firmware update, or probably more likely see the pricing come down a little bit, so that if it were $10 less than the Intel drives, or $20 less than that Intel drive, it would make, you know, good sense. This is actually, it's a better value and its performance is better or nearly as good in many areas, type of thing. But when it's not quite as fast and it's also not quite as inexpensive, it makes it hard to recommend that one over, you know, the opposite of that, I guess, right? just makes sense to me.
You're not recommending this one over the opposite.
Yeah. I mean, it's not slow. It's still an SSD. You're still getting a lot of these huge performance benefits that you would get over traditional hard drives. But now that, you know, when we're comparing these things, sometimes the differences are fairly small, but our job is to tell you which one we like the best. It's not like if last week you happened to buy one of these Vertex 3.20s that you should try to return it or anything like that. It's not that big of a deal. It's just if you're looking at it today, the Intel one is a little bit faster and it's a little bit cheaper, you go with that one.
But the reality is, in day-to-day computing, you're probably not going to notice, at least until you get out towards the far end of the write cycle, likely for an SSD owner.
I would think that's the case, yeah.
What may or may not be the case, NVIDIA, will they or will they not release desktop-class GeForce 700 series GPUs at Computex 2013? Tim Berry writing this up for PC Per. Quote, the new card will reportedly be faster than currently available GTX 600 series, but will likely remain based on the company's Kepler architecture. Is there any, I mean, is it likely that NVIDIA will release the next generation GPUs at Computex 2013, or is at this point just complete guesswork? And I'm not trying to slag on Tim when I say this. I'm just...
No. I mean, it's still guesswork. I think it's as good a spot to release it as any, I guess. The only drawback I would see to releasing a new graphics line at Computex is that Intel's going to release Haswell at Computex. So it depends on how much noise there's going to be because of the show in general. You know, we've seen this with CES and a lot of other things where people like to announce their products a week or 2 weeks before or a week or 2 weeks after, just to make sure that the majority of the press is now focused on them as opposed to it being scattered out all over. But I mean, we're coming up on a year and a third or so of time since the release of the Kepler graphics card. And if the rumors of what this is, it's going to be like an updated version of Kepler, you know, based on the GK110 chip, not a drastic architecture change like Kepler was from Fermi. You know, we always get asked on the show, when are these next cards going to come out? And we still don't know for sure, but now there are rumors and speculation for you at least to consider.
Speculation is good.
Keeps things moving.
So the Zotac Nano, Intel's next unit of computing, little tiny small PCs, now have a companion, Gigabyte's Bricks. What do we know about the Bricks other than it's a computer that comes in a very small box?
That's pretty much it, right? I mean, it's meant to compete against those products, the Nano and the Nook. I think the Bricks has a better name than those two. Maybe not the Nano. Nook. I don't like the Intel Nook. I don't like.
Probably
I think
the that's Nook kind of a thing you put in a teething child's mouth to get it to quiet down. I mean, a Nook is a little rubber plug. I always thought that was a little bizarre. The next unit of computing, but essentially. We know the Bricks is going to have an Intel CPU. It's going to use mSATA for storage, mini PCI Express SoC for Wi-Fi. And, of course, it's a small case. So the BRICS motherboard measures 100 by 105 millimeters. The case with internals measures 114.8 by 108 by 29.5 millimeters. Weighs 400-ish grams seems to be a big number in my life this week. That's like the third 400-gram thing I've talked about. I don't know what that's all about. I mean, what are we talking about? You know, Core i3 or no? Okay, here we go. Intel Celeron, Intel Core i3 3227, Core i5 3337, or Core i7 3537U. This could be a kick-ass home theater PC. Probably, though, not going to be your 3D gaming box. Oh, can you imagine if you get a decent GPU in a box that small?
I mean, it depends on what you consider decent GPU. I assume that all of these designs will be refreshed at some point down the line, a little bit later after Haswell's release. It will have the potential to be a better GPU. If nothing else, a better GPU per watt. So you'd be able to get as small or smaller designs or maybe a little bit higher performance in the same thermal envelopes and that kind of stuff as well. But I mean, this Gigabyte one looks like it's offering a little bit faster processor options than the Nook. But otherwise, it's very similar. Oh, no, this one does have two DIMM slots. I think the other one only had one. No, maybe it had two. I can't remember now exactly if the Nook had one or two. But otherwise, it has one SATA port, one mini PCIe slot, Wi-Fi, and VESA mount capability, right? So it's very, very similar to what you got with the Nook and with some of the Zotac Nano devices. It's pretty cool. USB 3, HDMI, DisplayPort video output, gigabit LAN, which is good considering the kind of overheating issues we have with the Wi-Fi plus SSD on the Intel a while ago.
But it's amazing how painful such a what you would think of as being a done technology Wi-Fi, but you can still like hold something and be like, "Duh, that's more wattage than my CPU is pumping out."
Yeah.
NVIDIA getting a special bundly treat. What's the word on that, Ryan?
I thought this was worth mentioning. I think Metro Last Light is getting a lot of attention. A lot of people were worried it was going to get canceled when THQ went under. That is not the case. It actually comes out May 1st, May 17th. It's in May. It's coming up pretty soon. I think it's May 17th. Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon, the 80s remix of Far Cry 3, comes out May 1st, I think it was. But Metro Last Light, NVIDIA is going to be bundling that. Actually, I think they're already running that as of now. If you buy a GeForce GTX 660 or higher, you can get a free copy of Metro Last Light. It was just kind of interesting to see. AMD has been getting all the big name titles recently, you know, Far Cry 3, Crysis 3, Bioshock Infinite, Tomb Raider, all that kind of stuff. And NVIDIA had gone with the free to play model, PlanetSide 2, World of Tanks, and Hawken, you know, kind of giving people credit towards those free to play games. But now they're kind of coming back into the world of maybe we do need that AAA title to kind of pull people in. And it's it'll be curious to see, is this maybe a promotion to start selling through GTX 600 series cards if, in fact, there are 700 series cards coming, you know, in the June, July, or something like that time frame?
If maybe. Could be.
Possibly. If maybe. You're not There's a lot of if maybes.
Twit.tv/Twitch is where you can find Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, all of our previous episodes, all of our future episodes. And if you want to email us, do us a favor, email twitch@twit.tv, which I bring up because in just a moment, we're going to be answering viewer questions. We love your questions. We love your guidance. We love to hear what you're doing with your computers, especially if you've been doing some crazy hacking, overclocking, system building, or just having fun. We'd love to hear about it. Twitch. T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. You'd think I know the email by now. I want to thank our new friends at Man Packs. I got a box with underwear and razors in it. This is so cool. It's one of the basically a new sponsor here at Twitch. I'm obviously way too excited about a box full of underwear and razors. Ryan, could
I got mine was filled with underwear and socks and undershirts. Socks. Actually, yeah. Good socks, too. I've been a fan. So here's the Man Packs pitch. As a guy, there's always basic stuff that you forget to buy until it's too late. I think this is true whether or not you are single or married. I think
with children.
That actually would make it worse. Forgetting things becomes a little bit easier in that way. So finding good products takes time. Underwear and socks, face scrub, natural shaving cream. You need these things every day, but spending time shopping for them can be a pain. After work, there's sports, games, friends, family. Maybe you host shows on a on a live TV network or something like that. Who wants to surf the web for socks? Guys don't have to ever shop for Manly Basics again because of Manpacks. Join the thousands of us that have already signed up. The Manpacks is, as they call it, a start it, stop it, change it anytime subscription for all of your basic essentials. It's easy to manage your account, and they remind you before shipments so there are no surprises. You update your next pack when you need something, or you just wait for it to come to you every 3 months. Every product is tried and guy approved by Manpacks. No duds or junk, just pure win. There's free shipping. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I was excited because one of my favorite brands of underwear, the Ex-Officio boxer shorts that I pretty much lived in for the last few years, were available. And, well, you laugh, right? I'm telling you right now, pull off your shoe, take a look at your sock. You know, are there worn sections of your sock you can see through? I do not wear the fitted boxer. I guarantee you that, ladies and gentlemen, that would be too much even for the woman who loves me. Your life and physique may vary. But take a look. Can you see through your socks? Are there the worn out sections of your socks? Your underwear look like the dog's been at them. You know, these things wear out and they need to be replaced. And Manpacks can help you do that without leaving the house. Manpacks.com/twit. That's pretty cool. You get $10 off your first order or 30 of 30 or more. $10 off your first order of 30 or more, or you can buy a $50 gift card for $40. It's pretty neat. Like every quarter, a box of stuff you need will show up. In my case, apparently razors and underwear. And my wife actually is thrilled that I'm going to be clean shaven and I'm going to have underwear that doesn't look like the cat has been nesting right in it. Or
that's the key for me is where we're at the point where my wife, Kelly, would be like, you're still wearing that undershirt? It's like, what are you talking about? It's fine. She's like, And this kind of takes all that guesswork out of it. It's not like they're sending you 36 pairs of underwear every 3 months. You get to set up everything that you want, you know, you need to figure out. And then it's like, it shows up, they send you an email and say, hey, it's coming. And you're like, you know, yeah, you're right. I could, there's a couple of these I need to cycle out of there. Yeah. And freshen up some there. So check it out, manpacks.com/twit. And like Patrick said, $10 off your first order of 30 or more, or get a $50 gift card for $40. And we thank Manpacks for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thank you, manpacks/twit. manpacks.com/twit.
Yes.
Email, we told you, twitch@twit.tv is the email. Alex has a question about ultrabooks and screens. He says, I've got two quick questions for you. Brace yourselves. Alex has questions. First, I'm in the market for a new ultrabook. Should I wait for Haswell to arrive this summer, or will the gains be too marginal to offset the increased cost of brand new systems? It's still a 22-nanometer process, so how much of an impact could these additional power states have? Mr. Shroud. I at this point, I am not really telling anybody to wait for Haswell, but I could be wrong on this one.
So it's kind of an interesting thing. So Haswell will be out in the summer. I don't think it's a surprise. It's going to be in the Computex timeframe. But what will happen is we don't know exactly what products are going to be released when. I think it's going to be the higher power stuff first, and then it'll slowly trickle out into the lower power stuff. Mm-hmm. And there will be a price premium for the new systems. You know, it's almost the benefits that you'll have with Haswell are on the graphics side, and on the there will be some battery life improvements for sure. So if you're looking to buy an ultrabook, which means you want to get that thin profile, sexy looks, one of the things that you usually sacrifice with ultrabooks is battery life. So Haswell may be a considerable enough improvement for that for you to want to get that, but it's something where you may end up waiting until August or September before the right system with all the things you want is kind of available, not just shown off at Computex, but actually available for you to purchase. And those are two very different things sometimes. Just check out all news from CES. On the other hand, if you're maybe not super concerned about battery life, chances are in the April, May, June timeframe, you'll be able to get some Ivy Bridge machines at some discounted rates. That's usually how I buy my own personal laptops. My Lenovo X230, as I'm looking at it right here in front of me, is a Sandy Bridge-based system that went on sale after the Ivy Bridge systems had kind of started to be released and were out there. And Lenovo kind of starts doing their sales and coupons that they typically do. So I think that's your two options. Wait a little bit because you're not super concerned about some of the features that are coming on Haswell, the battery life, the connected standby. and you can save some money, or the other way.
Are we talking about like a 10% gain in battery life, a 20% gain in battery life? I mean,
20%, I think it's probably close to that 20 level would be my guess.
Okay.
Maybe.
That to me would almost be worth waiting for. That's 20% starts. That's a big deal.
I don't know this from firsthand knowledge yet. This is not anything that I am, you know, precognitive of. If I were guessing, everything that I'm being told is that Haswell improves battery life much better compared to Ivy Bridge than Ivy Bridge did compared to Sandy Bridge. So even though it's on the same 22-nanometer process, as Alex mentions in the question, I think there's going to be more benefits there than there have been in the past.
There you have it. Alex's second or part two of his question, what's coming down the pipe in the monitor market? We know that the LCD screen OEMs like LG are producing 3840 by 2160, aka 4K displays for the television market. There's also been some discussion that the screen surplus fueling the Korean suppliers may be drying up. Prices are certainly rising on eBay. Twit's own Frame Rate reported on the unconfirmed rumor that the unconfirmed Apple TV was having trouble finding 4K screens and would be delayed, which was also unconfirmed. Would the manufacturers even have the incentive or technology to manufacture these screens in desktop size dimensions? How much longer do I need to wait before buying a 30-inch 4K desktop monitor? Come on, guys. My eyes are still too healthy. I need more reason to squint. I'm going to be honest with you. I think a 30-inch 4K desktop monitor is a long-ass way away, because at this point, there is almost no market for a WQHD, a 27 or 30 inch 2560 by 1440 monitor, right? In part because nobody wants to pay $700 for a monitor from a major manufacturer. And, you know, again, as you notice, you know, there are enough enthusiasts, whether it is geeks such as Ryan and myself, or people who are like, hey, I live in Photoshop. Hey, I live in video production. I want more real estate, or I want more pixels on my 3D gaming experience. I don't see 4K coming to the desktop anytime soon, at least not in volume. However, 4K HDTVs are on the market a good year to 2 years before I expected to see them at the high end. Hey, mm-hmm. They're selling for $1,500. So maybe your 4K monitor is a 50-inch Seiki from Tiger Direct. Because at 4K is a dense enough resolution where a 50-inch monitor suddenly becomes a usable, if not practical, desktop display. I do not want a 50-inch HDTV on my desk, certainly not at 1080p. At 1080p, the pixels are going to look like this.
There's the red pixel. There's the blue pixel. There's the green pixel.
I exaggerate slightly, but a 40-inch desktop monitor that's 3 feet from your face at 1080p is going to be painful to use. At 4K, it becomes usable. But do you have room for a 50-inch 4K desktop monitor? I get excited about resolutions on desktops.
No, and I agree with you. I think about the idea of not seeing 4K like 30-inch displays yet. But mm-hmm. what gives me pause is the fact that we had the 17-inch 2560 by 1700 monitor on that Chromebook Pixel, or I think we saw we talked about on Tech News Today that I was on earlier about a 13-inch 2560 by something laptop as well. So they're getting them down to these super small screen sizes. And I think a 4K at a 30-inch or 32 or 34 would almost be like the ideal one. 50 mm-hmm. inches too big to sit on my desk. That's what we did today in our video. Right. It's too big. 30 inches about kind of the maximum for a desk distance that I can imagine. And the more pixels, the better, I guess. If they can do it, great. But I kind of agree with you that I don't think there's a big push for it, because I think the difference between 4K and 2560 by 1600 is not as dramatic as 4K versus 1080p. So the drive to get the TV going from 1080p to 4K is probably higher, stronger than on PC displays.
It's an interesting question. I would be shocked if we see more than one or two manufacturers with a 4K desktop monitor between now and Christmas. I have, however, proven to be astoundingly wrong in the past on that. Not so astoundingly wrong. Our advice for actually Ryan's always right. It's me that occasionally messes up. Wendell's got a question, an email with a question about an upgrade on a $200 budget. I guarantee you this advice will be stunningly correct from either one of us. He says, I am sure you get these emails all the time. But by the way, I'd like to nominate myself right now for the worst segue of 2013 so far.
All right, write it down.
In any case, Tony, if you didn't edit that out, let us readdress Wendell, who says, I am sure you get these emails all the time, but I'm at a loss as to what to do. I was given $100 for my birthday this year that I want to use to upgrade my computer in some way. I play numerous Steam games, but do not feel the need to have the absolute highest graphics or anything. Many current games are running very choppy now, even on lower settings, specifically BioShock Infinite and games like Borderlands 2 and Tomb Raider. Here's my current system. Core 2 Duo E8400 at 3 gigahertz, 4 gigabytes of RAM, a whole bunch of 5 hard drives from 160 gigabytes to 620 gigabytes, a 1920 by 1080 monitor, the one he uses for gaming, a 1680 by 1050 monitor, and an NVIDIA GeForce 9800 GT. I really only want to spend an extra $100 for a total budget of $200. I feel pain here because I don't know whether to tell him to upgrade the CPU first or the GPU first.
That's tough, right? The Core 2 Duo is pretty old. It's pretty long in the tooth. My gut instinct is to go with the GPU first.
Okay.
It usually is my gut instinct to go with the GPU first, even when we stretch back into CPUs of this caliber. Go ahead.
Oh, I said
this GPUs vintage.
This vintage.
Yeah, exactly. And especially because his budget is only $200, because he wouldn't be able to just replace the processor. He'd have to replace the motherboard and the processor at this point. And you won't be able to really do that for $200 reasonably. You'd probably need maybe $300 to do it, I think. You know, get a $120 motherboard, you get a $180 processor, something like that. Right. However, you can get a card like the GTI 650 Ti Boost or the Radeon HD 7850. And those are going to be pretty dramatic increases over the performance of a 9800 GT. To put it in perspective, the 9800 GT is the card that NVIDIA uses in their own graphs to talk about upgrade cycles, right? So that means that you are at the 4 or 5 year mark with the 9800 GT. When I did talks at BlizzCon in front of people and said, look, we're playing StarCraft 2 and we're playing World of Warcraft, but look at the difference we get running on a 9800 GT or an 8800 GT versus what was at the time, I think, a GTX 560 Ti or something like that. And it was a pretty big boost. The GTX 660 is $199, $189 after rebate. And then I think NVIDIA or the AMD equivalent to that would probably be the 7870. So kind of look around at whichever games you're looking to play, BioShock and that kind of stuff, and see what results there are out there. And I think the graphics card's the way to go. But you are going to have to move up eventually on the CPU side as well.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough when you get to that 4 or 5-ish year mark. If you kind of slowly upgrade something major every couple of years, it's easier to do. But it gets frustrating because the other thing is at some point like, oh, okay, you know, I upgrade the CPU, I upgrade the motherboard, and I also have gonna have to upgrade the memory, and it gets frustrating. Somebody in the chat room was like, sell the old system, build something new, but you're not going to get as much money as you want for the old system.
I don't know.
Quincy has a question about rendering. Says, I'm looking to upgrade my Core 2 Duo 3 gigahertz system. It's Core 2 day here on Twitch. Back in the day, AMD was a problem with overheating and stability. I am sure they are a lot better now. I am considering AMD due to my budget. I want to build a decent, affordable video editing system. Question, AMD or Intel, which would be better for editing and rendering video? Technically speaking, I am sure for my pocket, AMD would be better. I use Sony Vegas at the moment. Also, is a dedicated rendering card still relevant with today's GPU CPU power? At the consumer end, with a short answer is, you know, if you're the kind of person that goes to NAB and looks at $10,000 systems, dedicated rendering cards are probably something worth considering, assuming they even still exist at this point. Sony Vegas, I do not think is accelerated by the GPU, which means to me, if you plan on staying on Sony Vegas and not moving to Premiere, and I would not recommend anybody move to Final Cut right now. Of course, in your case, it would also require moving to OS X on top of moving off of Sony Vegas. But boy, man, I want to say like Intel Core i5 over AMD, or am I just being mean?
No, I think that's probably pretty good. The one area where AMD's CPU platforms do better than expected, I don't want to say better than Intel, but better than expected, is on highly threaded workloads like video encoding. If you go back and look through our CPU reviews where we compare the AMD FX8350, you'll see that it does fairly well against the Core i5s in that regard. Okay. And it's going to be less expensive. Now, what it is not is more power efficient. It's going to use more power, so it's going to generate more heat. If that's a concern for you, then you probably want to look down at Intel as well. But AMD can do a lot in that regard. Where it struggles is on single-threaded performance. But in general, if you're doing video editing, those are all highly threaded applications, especially when you get into the actual video encoding part of it. Yeah. And then in terms of a dedicated rendering card, probably not on your budget. So, like, if you look at – here's what you should do. If you didn't tell me what you did say, he's using Sony Vegas. Go search around for which – graphics cards, either GeForce or Radeon, will accelerate Sony Vegas. And that's what you need to look at buying. You can get into Quadro and Fire Pro. Those will be more likely to be supported, but they're also going to be significantly more expensive. So I would, you know, we talked about it last week or 2 weeks ago that Adobe was moving to OpenCL. So that would be supported by almost every card out on the market. Sony Vegas, I know, has GPU acceleration for video decoding, so like while you're in the editing process, and I think they do for encoding as well, although I tend to lean on CPU-based encoding just because of its quality control that you have in that regard. But search around. It won't be hard to find people who are using either GeForce cards or Radeon cards, and you might even just be able to go to the Sony Vegas site and look up, you know, supported hardware.
I was looking around, and I'm actually having difficulty finding... apparently because I looked on the wrong section of the website. They do now have a GPU acceleration for titles and text plugin and GPU accelerated performance. All right. So that is relatively new to Sony Vegas in my experience. And of course, finding the actual hardware list is proving impossible, just to be cruel.
Yeah, it happens too. I mean, it's one of those things where when you get into those kind of professional prosumer level applications, you just need to kind of pay attention to what they recommend using. You know, for a while it was, if you wanted to use Adobe Premiere Pro, you should have an NVIDIA Quadro card in there because you were going to get a much better experience out of it. It wasn't a necessity, but it was going to be a significant advantage, I think. So with Sony Vegas, you should probably look that way as well.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. One more question before we go.
Sure.
All right. We have Michael has a question about graphics of a 13-inch laptop. He says, I want to know if my fantasy of an Ultrabook will come to fruition with the introduction of Haswell. 13.3-inch, 1080p touchscreen, 8 gigabytes of RAM, Thunderbolt port, and here's the hard part, discrete NVIDIA 700 or AMG 800 card, 8,000 card. With the current-gen Ultrabooks, the only one with a discrete graphics card is a 15-inch by Asus. Boy, you don't want much, do you, Michael? I see that head going back and forth. That is not the head shake of hope from Mr. Shroud.
Well, I don't think – I mean, his statement was the only one with the discrete graphics is the 15-inch by Asus. And that's not the case because I know we reviewed at the release of Ivy Bridge Ultrabooks that there were some that had discrete NVIDIA GT 600 series graphics in it. The problem is when you get in the Ultrabook – the problem with putting a discrete graphics chip in an Ultrabook is you have battery life concerns, but mostly you have thermal constraints inside the chassis. So the smaller the design of the system, the less room they have to put heat sinks in there, which means the less heat that they can dissipate, which means the less processing power they can put inside the system in theory. And adding a discrete GPU adds a complication to it. Obviously, NVIDIA and AMD to a certain extent want to promote discrete graphics in these systems as much as possible, because otherwise they're left out of that entire market. I think the problem that you will find as we proceed down Haswell and future architectures is that fewer and fewer systems will use discrete graphics because of improvements in Intel's graphics system on their processor graphics, on their HD 4000 or 5000 or whatever they're going to call it this next generation. Right. I think you will be able to find a 13.3-inch 1080p. I think you'll be able to find that system with Haswell.
With the latest generation of GPU incorporated? Because that was kind of got me hung up, was like, he wants like the next generation of GPU in there. That kind of gave me pause.
So the mobile version, so here's what's going to happen. It's going to be it's going to be a next generation labeled part, but it's going to be based on Kepler architecture, and it's going to be low power. You're not going to get the performance of a GTX 680M or 670M into an Ultrabook. You're just not going to do it. You're going to get something like the GT 650 or something equivalent to that. And a GT 650 is faster than, you know, HD 4000 for gaming, but it's not worlds better anymore that it used to be. So I think you'll be able to find that, but I think you'll probably find more likely is that you will probably require that discrete GPU less towards the end of this year, would be my guess.
But if you want to, but it sounds like what Michael's looking for though is full on gaming, a gaming Ultrabook essentially. Something like, I mean, the next generation of say Gigabyte's U2442D, where it's like a Core i5 and GeForce GT730M GPU integrated in there.
So it exists, right? They're there, and we just haven't had enough testing time with the 700 series. The 700 series is essentially the 600 series with a couple of things changed. They add support for like a GPU boost-like technology to balance thermal headroom between the CPU and the GPU and increase gaming performance and that kind of stuff. So I still think there's value in having a discrete chip. What is key for NVIDIA and AMD is to make sure that their products can be as unintrusive to the design and unintrusive to the long-term battery life of a system when you're not using the GPU for gaming, right? And then if you want to use the GPU for gaming, they say, well, it's going to cut your battery life in half, so make sure you've got your power brick nearby. Also, we're going to have to spend some more fans and that kind of stuff. If they can do that, I think the idea of having a balanced machine that can both be an ultra portable and be a gaming machine without going back to the whole idea of, oh, I'm going to have an external discrete graphics card or something like that, is still possible. I mean, every generation of GPU gets better, just like every generation of Intel CPU gets better. It's just a matter of which one is taking a bigger step each iteration.
Now I really, really, really want that Gigabyte U2442D because it's like $1,069 with the Core i5-3230M and that GPU we mentioned.
Yeah.
I'm like, and 8 gigabytes of RAM and a 16 by 900 display. Wow, 630 in graphics.
That's if, nice. If you go, it's interesting to see, like, so Gigabyte doesn't really sell in the U.S. very much. I think Newegg might sell them now. And MSI used to be like this as well, where they're, you know, they're making very similar products to what's out there, and sometimes really cool. Like MSI has really, really cool gaming laptop designs, but they're not available in retail. They're not a big name like Alienware in that market, so they're harder to find. But they're offering them significantly less expensive in order to help get their name out and to get products out there. And I think Gigabyte's doing the same thing. You know, the fact that you can get a pretty decent Ultrabook with all those kinds of specs for right around $1,000 is pretty sweet.
It is pretty sweet. Oh my goodness. What's coming up on PC Pro this week, sir?
So I guess the big news, so we posted a preview of that 4K TV. We have some other things going on. We're doing some more graphics card testing, go figure, right? But we did launch a Indiegogo project, which is, if you don't know what that is, it's like Kickstarter, but it's just a different outlet for it that has a little bit more flexibility on certain things. And we are launching it to try to improve PC Perspective's ability to produce quality and frequent content for PC hardware enthusiasts, right? So we already do a little bit of hard video stuff, but our goal is to increase that. Our goal is to make it so this is something that we can do every day. We don't have to, like we did today when we did the 4K video, we had to move cables around. We had to resituate cameras, and we had to – it took a couple of hours of process and setup to kind of get to where we were ready to do a live stream, as opposed to if we just had some money to build out what we have had planned for more than a year in terms of designs and schematics and that kind of stuff, that we could just turn it on and go, turn it on and go. That's what we want to get to. So we're asking for people, if they've read an article at PC Perspective, written a review, if the hardware leaderboard has helped you, if the frame rating stuff has been like really cool research that you appreciate, to go to PCPro.com. On the right-hand side, you'll see a kind of goofy picture of me standing there that is a Indiegogo embedded thing. You can click on that picture. It'll take you to our page. It shows you some of the things that you can get if you donate, like ad-free versions of the sites and T-shirts and that kind of stuff. And if you want to, please donate. We would really appreciate it. It would be a big help for us as we try to improve what we're doing for the rest of 2013 and beyond.
Ladies and gentlemen, hie thee over to Indiegogo and support our friends.
Thank you. PC. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your support. Oh, my goodness. More Raspberry Pi mayhem coming over at we're basically going to be doing a Plex build on the Raspberry Pi. We've got the Seiki the 50-inch 4K HDTV. Robert's going to get that. Hopefully it arrives today or tomorrow. Hopefully it arrived today. I'll have to look upstairs or tomorrow. And we're going to get that in the lab and benchmarked. And I'm very excited. We're actually relaunching the long format of HD Nation. And I'll have
news on where you
can find that. Yeah, we're basically going to do a long format show again, which is all home theater HD content, which I'm extremely excited about because I've been trying to expand it back out again for quite some time. And of course, we're going to be getting crazy on Techzilla. Well, I'll tell you more about what we did next week.
Cool.
Although I will say we did have a lot of fun. We showed off BitTorrent's new sync. And it's kind of like remote backup or a DIY private Dropbox using BitTorrent. That's cool. And that's on Techzilla, TEKZILLA.com right now. PCPer.com is the home of Ryan. At Ryan Shrout is where you can find Ryan on Twitter, or at Patrick Norton. And I'm going to say that's it for this edition of Twitch. We'll see you next week. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
And we'll see you next week, which apparently I needed to say twice today. Night, everybody.